morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, March 31st. It is 1:06 p.m. With me at the table this afternoon, Co-Chairman Kelly.
Hello.
Vice Chairman Michiki.
Hello.
Senator Hoffman.
Good afternoon.
Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good afternoon.
And we should be joined shortly by Senator Olson. On today's agenda, we have two topic items. We have the confirmation hearings on the Mental Health Trust Authority, Lorraine Deer and Jerome Selby. Jerome is online. Is there anything else to come before the committee? The second topic that we'll take up is SB 91, and it'll be community supervision. Mr. Selby, are you there?
What's that?
Mr. Selby, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Mr. Selby, welcome to Senate Finance. Do you have some opening remarks for the committee's consideration before we start asking you questions?
Sure, I'd be glad to, Madam Chairman. I just, the Mental Health Trust Authority represents the kind of interest that I enjoy working on. I think I've got some good experience and background that might be helpful and useful to the Trust Board and to the folks of the state of Alaska in moving ahead. I have extensive experience in development of resources for the Kodiak Island Borough, where I served as mayor for 24 years, as well as my time on the Outer Continental Shelf Advisory Committee for the Department of the Interior, where we did all of the lease sales for the oil and gas resources offshore of the United States. So I have a pretty good idea of that. I'm very familiar with timber, for example, because Fognak Island has had some of the most aggressive timber harvesting and management in the last 25 years of anywhere in the state of Alaska. And the borough was involved with working with the Fognak and the other native corporations in that development. So I've got a good understanding of resource development. I'm a proponent of developing wisely for the benefit of all Alaskans, and I see the Mental Health Trust as being responsible for helping all of Alaskans. We can do that by managing resources, opening up jobs for Alaskans that will help the overall Alaskan economy, as well as obviously the folks working there. But then the byproduct is that it generates additional funding for the Trust Authority itself to be able to fund programs that are targeted for the specific beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. And so the more resources we have to work with there, the more we can do with those folks. At this time, particularly given the state budget situation, I think there's a good opportunity here for us to work closely with the Department of Health and Human Services to maximize what can be accomplished for our mutual beneficiaries in the Mental Health Trust, as well as what the State Department does. And we should be doing that. It's time for us to pull together as Alaskans and do everything that we can, even though times are tight, budgets are tight. We can do a lot, still do a lot for folks, and my interest is in seeing to it that we do the most we can with the resources that we do have to work with. And that's always a bit of a challenge, but I've been making those kinds of decisions and have been involved in those discussions, that type of discussions, for the last 30 years here in Alaska. And I think I have a pretty good feel for the kinds of questions that need to be asked, the things that need to be done to maximize what can be done with what resources we have, even when budgets are tight. And so I'm looking forward to that. It's the kind of thing that I enjoy doing. I look forward to the challenge of doing the best with that we can. And we'd be glad to answer any questions you folks have.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? I'd like to outline for the committee what we should be considering under 4730.010, Board Establishment, Members' Quorums, Fees, and Expenses. The authority shall be governed by its Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees for the Mental Health Trust Authority consists of seven members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislatures. legislature. The members appointed under this section shall be appointed based on their ability in finance management and investment in land management or in services for the beneficiaries of the trust. After the governor has considered a list of persons prepared by the panel of six persons who are beneficiaries or who are guardians, family members, or representatives of beneficiaries, the panel shall consist of one person selected by the Alaska Mental Health Board, one person selected by the Governor's Council on Disability and Special Education, one person selected by the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, one person selected by the Alaska Commission on Aging, and one person selected by the Alaska Native Health Board, one person selected by the authority. Mr. Selby, do you know which position you're appointed under?
Actually, I do not, Madam Chairman.
That's fine. If I could ask Jeff Jesse to the microphone. Mr. Jesse, if you could identify yourself and if you could tell the committee which particular seat on the board is being filled by Mr. Selby's application.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Those positions that you just named off are for the nominating committee. Those members meet and solicit applications. They interview some of the candidates. They then make a recommendation to the governor, which the governor must consider. He doesn't have to pick from the list, but then the governor makes his selection. So there are no designated seats on the board.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification. Mr. Selby, it goes on to say what a member may not do may not be an officer or employee of the state. Have you been or are you an officer or employee of the state?
No, ma'am.
And within the preceding 2 years or during the member's term of office, have an interest in, serve on a governing board of, or been employed by an organization that has received during the same period money from the Mental Health Trust Settlement Income Account under a grant or contract services?
No, not in the last 2 years, Madam Chairman. Obviously, when I was mayor of the Kodiak Island Borough, we managed the Kodiak Island Mental Health Center. We did interact with the trust back in those days, but then we since have contracted that to Providence. And so, I haven't been mayor for 2.5 years, so.
Thank you very much. Senator Dunleavy.
Just a brief at ease.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. There was a conversation or a question a moment ago regarding whether you could have a grant or be a contract employee of the state. That would be for someone from legal to determine that particular answer. Each board and commission that we have is governed by a somewhat unique set of circumstances. Mr. Selby, are you available to attend meetings? I see that you're a private business owner. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
And do you believe that you'll be able to participate in meetings as well as committee work? The Mental Health Trust Authority works by committee?
Yes, ma'am. I've been participating in the meetings for the last 2 months, and even though it's my busy season for these 2-3 months, then I'll have much more time availability. I'm planning on attending and spending 3 days getting oriented and attending the board meetings in May in Anchorage. And so I don't anticipate a problem there at all.
Thank you very much. Is there any additional questions for Mr. Selby? Mr. Selby, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'd ask Lorraine Durr to the microphone. Lorraine, if you would identify yourself for the record, and then please provide the committee any opening remarks on why you would like to continue serving on Alaska's Mental Health Trust Authority.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Lorraine Durr. I live here in Juneau, Alaska. I've been on the Mental Health Trust for about 9.5 years. I went on in the fall of 2005. Why I would like to continue, as you know, the Mental Health Trust has a big plate in front of it and a lot of issues that come up. I serve the as the person with the finance experience. You asked earlier, Senator, about the makeup of the board. We like to have people on the board with several different backgrounds, and since we have so much land available, so many different things, it's nice to be welcoming Jerome Selby to the board, who has the healthcare background. We have people with real estate background, property management background, and I've got the finance background. So therefore, I would like to continue to be a member of the Mental Health Trust.
Questions from committee members? Mr. There has been a question of 9.5 years on the board. There's a reason that there is a limit to service. You can speak to it. I understand that you're legally qualified, but you seem to be termed out and being reapplied based on a technicality.
Sure. The law reads that you can serve 2 full 5-year terms. The term expired in March of 2005, and in the fall of 2005, I was appointed to the board. So when I was asked if I was interested in continuing for another term, we checked the legality of it to see if I was indeed able to serve, and I was. But then in the meantime, I mean, it's been one of these things that's sort of been up and down. A year ago in February, Governor Walker replaced me. He replaced me with someone who was subject to appointment then in March. When the legislature did the appointments last year, that person wasn't confirmed, which put me back on the trust. I went to the governor at that time and said, you know, if you want me gone, I mean, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But I'm willing to continue to serve if you're willing to appoint me. He reviewed my credentials, reviewed my my resume, and said he would like me to continue. So I was reappointed to that position that I was replaced in, but again, subject to confirmation this year. So it's been one of these, yes, I am on, no, I'm not, yes, I am. And once he reappointed me, I mean, I'm definitely willing to serve because it's a very important, plays a very important role in Alaska. I've been, you asked the question earlier, if you've been an officer or an employee of the state, as most of you know, I've been through many positions in the state as Commissioner of Revenue and so on. And so along the way, realize how important the Mental Health Trust is. And it keeps my finger in politics. So I like being on, I mean, I enjoy being on the board. I like the work and would like to continue to serve.
What, Mr., what's your availability to attend meetings? And if we pull your attendance record, what is that going to look like? Did you participate telephonically, or were you able to attend in person?
I attend in person. I think you'll see that I've not missed a meeting. I have that with the committee meetings. When I was chair of the different committees, I was there in person. When I've been a member of either the finance committee or a member of the resource committee, planning committee, I have attended some meetings by telephonically, but most of them I have attended in person.
And so would this be another full term, so you would actually be serving 14 and a half years in a seat that was supposed to be 10?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else to come before the committee on the Mental Health Trust? In accordance with AS 3905080, the Finance Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Lorraine Durr, Jerome Selby. This does not reflect an intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. Brief at ease while we sign the documents. Senate Finance is back on the record. If I failed to do so before, welcome Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson has been here for almost all of the meeting. The next item before the committee is SB 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill. Today we are speaking on the topic of community supervision. If I could invite Mr. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill, to the microphone. Mr. Schilling, if you could introduce yourself. For those at home, a document we'll be referencing is SB 91 ACJC Community Supervision Recommendation, sponsor Senator John Coghill, dated 3/31/2016. It should be available online under Senate Finance. Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So the Commission recommended policies aimed at strengthening supervision to reduce recidivism, and there's a very robust body of research in this area showing how to actually use probation and parole supervision to change criminal behavior. So for the last several years, the DOC has been taking steps to incorporate some of this new research into the way that they do probation and parole. And as a result, they've made some strides, but the Commission found several areas that could benefit from statutory changes. So first, the Commission recommended directing the DOC to create a graduated sanctions and incentives matrix This would be giving probation officers more tools in the toolbox to address bad behavior with quick sanctions or elicit good behavior with incentives. So even though, as I said, the department has been implementing some of these strategies and we have seen a reduction in recidivism since the early 2000s, we still have one of the highest recidivism rates in the country. As you've heard before, two-thirds of our offenders either violate or commit new crimes and return to prison within 3 years. And most of that recidivism occurs in the first 3 months upon release. So we know what it takes to reduce recidivism. There's a lot of research in this area. And what it says is the most effective punishments are swift, certain, and proportional to the misbehavior or the misconduct. And the carrot works better than the stick at gaining compliance. And so what this slide shows really is not only should the swift, certain, and proportional principle be applied with probation, but when you're looking at applying a punishment, it's important to have kind of a step up or a gradual increase and kind of reserve the most restrictive punishments to the worst conduct. So Alaska does have some of these systems in place. Alaska has the PACE program. I struggle on the acronym of PACE. I think it's probationary accountability and certain enforcement. I think that's what the program means, but it really uses some of these evidence-based strategies that I'm speaking of, but the vast majority of offenders on probation and parole do not fall in the PACE program, and currently the law does not give probation officers any options outside, of course, of filing a petition to revoke probation to address these violations. So the commission recommended that they have these extra tools and create a graduated sanctions matrix to include incentives to use these principles to reduce recidivism. The commission also recommended capping overall incarceration time for technical violations. One-fifth of our prison population is made up of people who have not committed a new crime, but have simply committed a technical violation of probation. And those in prison for a technical violation spend on average 106 days in prison. And despite this understanding that a swift and certain punishment is important, the data shows that many petitions to revoke probation take over a month to resolve. This is spending time in prison pre-trial prior to that violation being adjudicated. And once resolved, nearly half of probation violators spend over a month in prison. And some, as you can see on this slide, spend much longer than a month in prison for a technical violation. Again, not new criminal conduct. And according to the DOC, the most common types of technical violations are rule violations, like missing an appointment or changing an address without notifying the probation officer, alcohol-related violations, drug-related violations, and the large amount of judicial discretion that the courts have in sentencing these probation violations has led to this problem where the average amount of time someone spends in prison for a technical is 105 days, and that's how we've reached this point where a fifth of our prison population consists of these individuals. And so these delayed, random, severe sanctions don't work, so the commission recommended some quick dips in prison, similar to the PACE model, to respond to probation violations. So on this slide, you can see that the commission recommended for the first revocation for probation violations that individuals spend up to 3 days in prison, second violation 5 days, third 10 days, and then fourth and subsequent violations, the remaining suspended time can be imposed by the courts. As I mentioned in previous meetings, Senate Bill 91 does not treat all probation violations the same. There are some technical violations that are simply just worse than others, like not completing sex offender treatment, not completing batterer's intervention programming, absconding from probation. And so those are policies that, for the purposes of defining technical violation in the bill, have been excluded from that policy. Next, the commission recommended establishing a system of earned compliance credits. So today, offenders are kept on probation and parole for very long periods of time. And even those on probation that are deemed low risk and are not violating their conditions remain on probation caseloads long past the point where the data shows they are likely to reoffend. The data shows that if an offender does fail, they're most likely to fail in the first 3 months of probation. And almost all violations happen in the first year, if they're going to happen at all. So in other words, we can identify those individuals pretty early on, the ones that need sustained intensive supervision. And pretty early on, similarly, we can identify those that don't necessarily need to be on probation for long terms. And so the research shows that the carrot works better than the stick at reducing violations, and we have too many low-risk individuals consuming probation caseloads. And with so many low-risk individuals on these caseloads, it makes it difficult for our current probation resources to be focused on those most likely to reoffend. And that's a research principle that reduces recidivism. Right now, 39% of probationers are classified as low-risk. And supervising low-risk offenders for long periods of time costs the state a lot of money unnecessarily. And due to this fiscal environment, we don't have the ability to hire more probation officers to adequately supervise everyone. So the best case scenario for this bill would be to really allow the probation division to laser focus their resources on the worst offenders. So the commission recommended a month-to-month earned compliance credit to focus those resources. This is a policy that many states are using effectively, and it's one of the core components when it comes to incentivizing sustained compliance with the conditions of probation. The commission also recommended reducing maximum lengths of probation terms and standardizing early discharge. And so, as I said previously, people are spending more time on probation these days, up 13% since 2005. And these increasingly long terms of probation, as I just mentioned, are a little bit unnecessary when you kind of look at the data that shows clearly that most violations occur within the first year. And again, 40% of probationers are assessed at low risk. This is assessed at low risk by using a DOC risk assessment tool called the LSIR, Level of Services Inventory Revised. And so what this shows is there are 1,600 people on probation that are in the minimum bank right now. And some of this research is a little duplicative because a lot of the same research undergirds almost all of these probation recommendations. But in order to see a reduction in probation violations and a reduction in new crimes, it's important to front load and focus our very limited resources. And excessively long probation terms are unnecessary and aren't conducive to that approach. So the commission recommended limiting probation term lengths. These are the probation term lengths recommended by the commission. As the bill has evolved through the process, these lengths have increased. For example, 5 years for felony sex offenders and unclassified felony offenders has been increased to 10 years. There's a couple smaller changes, but that's probably the biggest alteration to this policy as it moves through the process. And also, the commission recommended discharging probationers and parolees after 1 year of perfect compliance on probation and parole, since the data shows they're very unlikely to reoffend after 1 year of sustained compliance. The commission recommended extending good time eligibility to offenders serving sentences on electronic monitoring. This is a fairly simple recommendation. Offenders that are in DOC facilities receive one-third good time off their sentences. Offenders serving time in CRCs, community residential centers, receive one-third off their sentence for good time. And so the commission recommended extending that credit to those serving their time on electronic monitoring. We've actually heard anecdotally that some offenders that are serving their time in CRCs that the commission would like to place on electronic monitoring actually turn that down because why would they? They're getting one-third off their sentence in the CRC and they're consuming a CRC bed when they could otherwise be spending that time on electronic monitoring. So the commission recommended to incentivize compliance with the conditions of EM. To allow offenders on EM to qualify for good time credits. The commission recommended focusing ASAP resources to improve program effectiveness. ASAP is the Alcohol Safety Action Program in the Department of Health and Social Services. And this is a program that was originally established to assess and refer DUI offenders to treatment. That was its originally core intended purpose, was to be to assess and refer those committing DUI offenses to treatment. But over time, referrals to ASAP have ballooned in size. Now offenders of all types, not just DUI offenders, are referred to ASAP. And that's placing a burden on the program that is making it difficult for ASAP to, again, focus its resources on those that need it the most. And so this slide talks about some of the referrals made to ASAP last year. ASAP received about 7,200 referrals. More than half were statutorily mandated. Those are the referrals that the legislature intended ASAP to be used for. But over time, the court system has sent people to ASAP that don't fit that original purpose. And I think the commission saw, you know, of all the referrals, there was a forgery offender that was sent to ASAP. And all of these extra referrals are making it so ASAP can't do what the commission would like them to do, which is to really expand and enhance the type of assessments that they do, and begin providing some modicum of supervision to the moderate and high-risk offenders. Finally, the commission recommended requiring CRCs, those are community residential centers or halfway houses, to offer treatment and to prevent the mixing of low and high-risk offenders. So the commission found that CRCs are likely mixing these high and low risk offenders. That's a research principle that's being violated, that having the low and the high together makes the low more risky. And the commission also found that CRCs could be more effective at reducing recidivism if they offered additional programming in those facilities. And so the commission recommended requiring cognitive behavioral treatment to be offered in these facilities, and to and for the department to adopt regulation that minimized the mixing of high and low risk offenders. So, Madam Chair, that is the conclusion of the summary of those recommendations.
Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where are the CRCs located in the state?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm sure DOC has a comprehensive list. I believe there's 8 facilities. I couldn't tell you where they all are, though.
Senator Bishop.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schilling, good job on your overview. Man, I was coming right back at you on a question that I had highlighted in the report, and you got it on slide 26. But along those lines, I was a little, I'm not taken back, but concerned that as we were talking about CRCs and the ways to improve outcomes, that there wasn't a specific action that I might have missed it, but talked about it's important that, you know, there's work programs at those CRCs where people leave in the morning and they come back in the evening, and they, you know, I know several businesses in Fairbanks that utilize the workforce there, and I just thought that might have been something that the commission would have focused on and wanted maybe to improve or expand on that work program. Thank you.
Mr. Schilling, do you have a comment?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I think you're right. CRCs, halfway houses, are a good opportunity to transition maybe a long-term sentenced offender into that type of environment before reentering society, and CRC would be the appropriate place to link individuals up with employment opportunities. If this committee wanted to address that in the context of CRCs, I'd be happy to work with you on it.
Thank you, Jordan, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Mr. Schilling. On page 3, I'm wondering the reason for the 2 years that are selected on the offenders released that returned to prison within 3 years. Why was FY 2002 and FY 11 selected?
My apologies, Senator Matiki, you're talking about slide 3?
Yes, sir.
And what was the question? My apologies.
Why were those 2 years selected?
Through the chair, Senator Matiki, I'm not sure why those two were selected. I would be happy to get the committee the recidivism rates for all of the years spanning 2002 and 2011, if that would be helpful.
Follow up.
Senator Matiki.
Not only that page, but page 8, I'd like to... I enjoy data, but I start wondering when different years are selected to make different points. So those 05 and 14, it'd be nice to understand if there's any significance to those 2 years as well.
Through the chair, Senator Patrick, absolutely. You're right that we're using sort of different 10-year windows on a lot of these slides. I will do my best to follow up and see if I can fill in some of those gaps for you.
And finally,
Senator Matiki.
Slide 18. Considering your suggestion and the recommendation to cap maximum probation terms in those four categories, can you please provide the percentage of folks beyond those lengths of time today that remain on probation?
Through the chair, Senator Matiki, so in other words, would you like to know what the average term of probation is currently for these different classes of offenders?
I would, and I'd like to know, like, for the felony sex offenders and unclassified felony offenders, how many today are serving, what percentage of folks on probation in those categories are serving terms longer than that?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Matiki, I have a little bit of data on that now, but I can follow up later. Felony offenders have average probation sentences of 3.69 years. Misdemeanor offenders have average probation sentences of 2.96 years. 17% of misdemeanor offenders have probation sentences of 5 years or more. And I can follow up with some more comprehensive numbers for you.
Right. So my interest is, if you're capping, I'd like to know how many are outside of that, and then I may have questions about why they've had longer terms beyond the caps.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Matiki, absolutely, yeah, and these are averages, so certainly there's going to be outliers that fall outside of those ranges. I can get that for you.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Oh, I just wanted to come back to Senator Machicki's earlier question on page 8, and I don't know if there's any correlation, but it was just something I read in the report. You know, the presumptive terms for incarceration were different in 2005 than they are currently, and if they weren't trying to capture some of that in that 10-year window, there might be some correlation there, because you know, you look at the presumptive terms in 2005, currently Alaska's serving. You know, the guidelines that were going on today, and then the recommendations by the commission going forward. You can see that on page 20 in the report. I didn't know if there was a correlation or not.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, so when we're talking about this policy, we're talking about someone who is no longer in a DOC facility and is on active supervision, either on probation or parole. And so the state of Alaska has never had a limit or a range on how long someone can spend in prison for probation violations. And so there always has been a wide range of judicial discretion in sentencing for this kind of conduct. And so Senate Bill 91 actually proposes putting a limit on that to prevent what you see here, which is offenders spending inordinate amounts of time in prison for relatively low-level conduct.
Any further questions for Mr. Schilling? We have two other folks to present. Senator Matiki.
Just a quick one. You can get back to me. Is a technical violation under Alaska law a secondary crime?
Through the chair, Senator Matiki, a technical violation is generally defined as any probation violation that is not a new offense. Although oftentimes when you look at DOC data that talks about probation violators, oftentimes a PTRP, a petition to revoke probation or parole, is put alongside a new offense, and so sometimes it's difficult to split the numbers out because oftentimes a probation violation is done alongside new criminal conduct.
Any further questions? Mr. Schilling, thank you for your presentation today. I'd like to invite Tony Piper. Tony, are you online? And Tony Piper?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Piper, if you could identify yourself for the record, I have you on my schedule as invited testimony to share your thoughts from ASAP's perspective, Alcohol Safety Action Program Coordinator. If you could identify yourself for the record, your affiliation, and then please provide us some feedback on community supervision.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Tony Piper, T-O-N-Y-P-I-P-E-R. I am the ASAP for Alcohol Safety Action Program Manager, and I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Behavioral Health. And I really have called in just to answer questions, if there are any questions.
Other questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Piper. Mr. Williams, if I could invite you, Acting Commissioner, Commissioner Designee, Department of Corrections. Mr. Williams, thank you for joining us again today.
Sure, Madam Chair. For the record, Dean Williams, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Corrections. I really don't have any really long statements. I just want to say, acknowledge that for the department, a lot of these recommendations are going to be a course change, a slight course change for us, caps on technical violations. We've struggled over that. We know other states have as well. This is going to be a learning curve for us. The department certainly supports the bill and the effort where we're going. There are going to be some challenges for us, good ones, graduated sanctions and developing meaningful graduated sanctions. I completely agree with incentivizing probation, by the way, and all the efforts that the bill prevents on that side. I've always felt, even in the juvenile as well as the adult system, we've got a lot of sticks in place and less carrots. And I think we need carrots in order to round out the justice system and incentivizing positive behavior and positive performance for probationees as well as inmates, of course, too. So,
thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Mr. Williams, I guess one of the questions that I have is, as you look at bureaucracies, and you're obviously in charge of a great bureaucracy, what's the chances of change happening? We realize that change has many resistant points in it. People that are under you, are they going to be they're probably not going to be welcoming this with open arms, but as you work through the system, what do you think your anticipated compliance is going to be?
Through the chair, Representative Senator Olson, this is a very good question, a very good point. In every other state I've been looking at, the type of challenge in front of us is really a policy direction. You've gotten plenty of testimony already about the you know, bureaucracy's grown when they're taking a new direction. I know I've been around for a long time, and now I'm back in charge of a very large agency. The good news in the fiscal times that we have, and the good news in bills like this that are pushing us, are that they make the system re-examine certain assumptions that more is better, certain assumptions that longer supervision or supervision of low-risk offenders is a good thing. I think until something like this comes along, you really don't, agencies are reluctant to sort of self-examine. I think that's the process of what this department's going to go through in a good way. I'm in this chair as the designee to do some things, not to be something in this position. And I've already picked some leadership staff that understand where we're going. There's support for that. And A lot of it is explaining and good communication and good training. And part of the change, this is a little off topic, but some of the changes that come after this, there's funds that we're going to get as a state to implement some of these changes and making sure that people understand what's going on. The time we have to implement some of these changes happen more quickly in some areas than others, but the bottom line is this is a good exercise. It's the right thing to do, and that's why I'm here.
Continue, Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson.
It may be the right thing to do, but if I see anybody that's unbending out there, it seems to be the correctional officers because of the reputation that they have, and at least of what's come back to me from people that have been in jail in my district. But that was more of a comment. The question I actually have for you actually is a tag along to what Senator Hoffman asked. Where are the CRCs here in the state of Alaska? The 8 or so that are in place. Do you have an idea where they're at?
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, the CRCs are, let me see if I can remember this, Fairbanks, Nome, Anchorage, Juneau, and Bethel. And there's the ones in Anchorage, there's two or three, there's three in Anchorage, and I think I think that's all of them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
Senator Machiki, did I see your hand up?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy, followed by Senator Bishop.
The Chair, Commissioner, do you see for C-tracking good time credit as an accounting issue, an accounting nightmare?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, you've hit it. One of the biggest concerns I have, and this is not a reason to throw, this is going to be a good problem for us to have, but the time accounting issue that we have in the state right now is probably the best and worst kept secret. It's the worst kept secret from my staff. We have to figure out time accounting. We have a real problem on our hands. Part of what I'm looking at next year already is what we do and what I'm going to recommend to the governor's legislative office about how we clean up time accounting. It is going to be another challenge. There is no doubt about it. But that does not negate the benefit of getting people out and incentivizing the change. The time accounting system, though, is a huge problem, Senator Dunleavy, and it is going to need a lift. I'll just leave it at that. I've been 2 months in this job, and what I'm seeing with time accounting and what it takes for people to get up to a level, even remote competence, it's a week-long course. Half the people fail that take the course. It's that complicated. And if we don't do something about that in the next go-around, I already have a going list for next year about what we need to do, but that does not negate the benefits of incentivizing probation as well as some of the other issues we have for inmates who complete their treatment.
Senator Bishop.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I have is overarching one on the whole piece of legislation, which I think is excellent in moving the state in the right direction, but I see problems of implementation over a period of time with all of the contract jails. How do you see many of the provisions in this legislation being implemented in contract jails?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, the issue of contract jails and the importance of them and what I think it's going to take in the future there's an area of how contract jails can be involved in part of the supervision, I think, of offenders and people out on probation, even pretrial services that we have not explored before. I think I have, since being in this job for 2 months, I'm not sure I've met with every contract jail representative in my office, but I can tell you that I met with many of them. And the contract jail system and the importance of contract jails is not going away, in my opinion. In fact, I think there's an opportunity for using contract jails differently and how they can assist. Some have approached me already with about electronic monitoring. Could they possibly be involved in electronic monitoring? So I think, as I said before, my other comments, in some of these challenges, there's opportunities that we have not explored before. And I think contract jails, I want to keep the contract jails healthy because they serve a huge purpose and they actually save money by keeping people local. But there's an opportunity in how we can expand their use cost effectively that maybe hasn't been explored as much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Further questions for designee Commissioner of Corrections Williams? Thank you. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. I've asked Mr. Schilling to come to the microphone. Because we're finished a little bit early today, I'd like to start, hopefully finish, but start a sectional walkthrough through over 100 sections of law that has changes to be made, some minor changes that require additional sections. Mr. Schilling, if you could place yourself on the record again and start a sectional walkthrough. That is available online also. So we have two different documents. One is a sectional analysis for Senate Bill number 91, version S. And the second piece is a piece of paper that pulls the sections together and color codes them into a group of categories called pretrial, sentencing, community supervision, and other. And the other will be addressed tomorrow morning, and I believe we have some experts that Senator Dunleavy requested yesterday on some of the conversation we had. Mr. Schilling.
Madam Chair, again for the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. This bill has 169 sections, so I'll go through them slowly. Would you like me to read the title of each statute as well as I go through this?
I don't think we need the title, but okay. What I'm going to be trying to follow, and if we move so that the general public can follow who's listening, I'd like to have a page number if we can do that. But I'll be flipping, so if you just pause, I can direct the community to a page number so that we're all following with you.
Okay, Madam Chair, the sheet that I have doesn't have corresponding page numbers. I just have sections on my cheat sheet, but if you'd like, I can kind of flip through the bill as we do it and try to identify the page numbers.
Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, I can start a bit ahead and have the page number and line to reference if you'd like as he begins the section.
Certainly. Mr. Schilling, if we gave you a minute, would that get you ahead so that you have to search so that we can get it going for you on the sections?
Madam Chair, if it works for the committee, I'll just start going through section by section, and I'll try to identify the corresponding
sections.
The number
sections. As you go. Okay.
Yep. Okay, thank great. So section one is just a conforming section to realign the misconduct involving controlled substance statutes. That can be found on page two of the bill. Section two, again, a conforming section related to the changes made later in the bill to our misconduct involving controlled substance statutes. That is on page 3. Section 3 increases the threshold value for theft in the second degree from $750 to $2,000. That's on page 3. Section 4 of the bill increases the threshold value for theft in the third degree from
Could you pause? Brief at ease. Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 3 of the bill contains Section 3, which relates to theft in the second degree. This section increases the threshold value for theft in the second degree from $750 to $2,000. Section 4 of the bill, which is contained on page 4 of the bill, increases the threshold value for theft in the third degree from $750 to $2,000. On page 4 of the bill, Section 5 increases the threshold value for concealment of merchandise from $750 to $2,000. On page 5 of the bill, Section 6 increases the threshold value for removal of identification marks from $750 to $2,000. On page 6 of the bill, Section 7 increases the threshold value for unlawful possession from $750 to $2,000. On page 6 of the bill, Section 8 increases the threshold value for issuing a bad check from $750 to $2,000. On page 6 of the bill again, Section 9 decreases the threshold value for fraudulent use of an access device from $750 to $50. On page 6 of the bill again, Section 10 is a conforming section as it relates to prior convictions for theft-related crimes. On page 7 of the bill, Section 11 reclassifies the crime of disregard of a highway obstruction to a violation punishable by up to a $1,000 fine. On page 7 of the bill, Section 12 increases the threshold value for criminal mischief in the third degree from $750 to $2,000. On page 8 of the bill, Section 13 increases the threshold value for criminal mischief in the fourth degree from $750 to $2,000. Page 8 again, Section 14 increases the threshold value for criminal simulation from $750 to $2,000. Page 8 again, Section 15 increases the threshold for misapplication of property from $750 to $2,000. On page 9 of the bill, Section 16 increases the threshold value for defrauding creditors from $750 to $2,000. On page 9 again, Section 17 establishes that not receiving a reminder notification from the court is not a defense to the crime of failure to appear. Page 9, Section 18 conforms to the reclassification of the crime of violation of conditions of release to a violation. On page 9 of the bill, Section 19 reclassifies the crime of violation of conditions of release to a violation punishable by up to $1,000. Page 9 of the bill, Section 20, conforms to renumbered statutes. On page 10 of the bill, Section 21, decreases the punishment for disorderly conduct from 10 days to 24-hour hold. On page 10 of the bill, Section 22, reclassifies the crime of attending an exhibition of fighting animals as a violation for the second offense and maintains that the third and subsequent offenses are a Class A misdemeanor. On page 10, Section 23 conforms to the reclassification of the crime of obstruction of highways to a violation. Page 10 of the bill, Section 24, reclassifies the crime of obstruction of highways to a violation punishable by a fine up to $1,000. Page 11 contains Section 25, which provides that a person may not be prosecuted for prostitution if they are cooperating with law enforcement in the reporting of one of the crimes listed in Section 25. Page 11, Section 26, reclassifies the crime of unlawful gambling to a violation punishable by a fine up to $1,000. Page 11 also has Section 27, which renames the crime of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree, and provides that manufacture or delivery of more than 2.5 grams of 1A, 2A, 3A substances is a Class B felony, and adds manufacture of methamphetamine or methamphetamine precursors as an element of the offense. Page 12 contains Page 13 contains Section 28, which conforms to renaming of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree as misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree. Page 13 also contains Section 29, which provides that possession of certain amounts of specific chemicals is prima facie evidence of intent to manufacture or deliver methamphetamine or methamphetamine precursors. Page 14 contains Section 30, which renames the crime of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree as misconduct involving controlled substances in the third degree, and provides that manufacture or delivery of less than 2.5 grams of a 1A, 2A, or 3A controlled substance, or any amount of a 4A or 5A controlled substance, is an element of the offense. Section 30, page 16 contains Section 31, which is a conforming section to rename misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree as misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree. Section 32 begins on page 16, but really on page 17, Section 32 renames the crime of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree as misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, and consolidates all simple possession of 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, and 5A controlled substances into misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree, except for very small quantities of specified 3A drugs. In this case, we're referring to spice. Page 18 contains Section 33, which simply renames the crime of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree to misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree. Page 18 also contains Section 34, which is simply a conforming statute to the realignment done in the misconduct involving controlled substance statutes. Page 19 contains Section 35, which provides that an arrested person shall appear before a judge or magistrate within 24 hours of arrest, absent compelling circumstances. Page 19 contains Section 36, which establishes a presumption of citations and a summons to court for nonviolent misdemeanors and Class C felons, with exceptions including significant danger to self or others and specified crimes. For infractions or violations, provides that a peace officer may bring a person before a judge if the violation is for a violation of conditions of release or failure to appear. Page 20 has Section 37, which forbids civil action for damages for failure to comply with this section. This is a liability provision asked for by the Anchorage Police Department. Page 20 contains Section 38, which reduces the minimum duration when issued a citation for certain offenses before the first appearance from 5 days to 2 days. Page 21 of the bill contains Section 39, which is conforming to allow the notice to appear to remain 5 working days after the issuance of a citation for certain offenses, including traffic violations. Page 21 contains Section 40, which is a conforming section to changes made in the bail provisions of the bill. Page 21, Section 41, requires judicial review and reconsideration of the conditions of release in cases where the defendant is detained pretrial due to those conditions, unless the judicial officer, the judge, finds that less restrictive release conditions cannot reasonably ensure the appearance of the person in court and safety of the victim, other persons, and the community. Page 21 of the bill, Section 42, allows for defendant's inability to pay to be considered as a factor once at a bail review hearing. Page 22 contains Section 43, which is a conforming section to the creation of the Pretrial Services Office, which authorizes a pretrial services officer to arrest a person without a warrant for violating a court order. Page 22 of the bill contains Section 44, which directs the first appearance in court to occur within 24 hours after the person's arrest, absent compelling circumstances. Page 22 contains Section 45, which limits judicial discretion to detain low and moderate risk pretrial defendants charged with nonviolent non-DUI misdemeanors and low risk pretrial defendants charged with nonviolent non-DUI Class C felonies. This section prevents the use of secured monetary bail for low-risk defendants while ensuring conditions can be imposed to require defendants to refrain from alcohol consumption, to avoid all contact with victims, and to keep regular contact with a pretrial services officer. And in determining the conditions of release, the court shall consider the conditions of release recommended by the pretrial services officer in the Department of Corrections and the person's pretrial risk assessment score. In addition to those conditions of release, the judge may impose the least restrictive conditions that ensure the person's appearance in court and the safety of the victim or other persons and the community. Page 26 of the bill contains Section 46, which creates a presumption of release on personal recognizance or unsecured bond with appropriate release conditions for low-risk defendants and for most nonviolent misdemeanor and Class C felony defendants. The court, of course, can overcome this presumption and order partially or fully secured money bond if it finds on the record that no less restrictive conditions can reasonably assure court appearance and public safety. Page 29 of the bill contains Section 47, which is a conforming section to the creation of the Pretrial Services Office, authorizing a pretrial services officer to search a person's residence for the presence of alcohol under conditions to refrain from alcohol. Page 29 is the beginning of Section 48, but really the meat of that section is on page 30, which is a conforming section to the creation of the Pretrial Services Office, authorizing a pretrial service officer to search a person's residence for the presence of a controlled substance under conditions to refrain from consuming controlled substances. A judicial officer may order a defendant to participate in random drug testing by the Pretrial Services Division. Page 30 contains Section 49, which restricts availability of third-party custodian release conditions to cases in which pretrial, DOC pretrial supervision is not available in that region in the state, and secured money bond has not been ordered, and no other combination of release conditions can reasonably assure court appearance and public safety. Page 31 of the bill contains Section 50, which changes the restrictions on people who are eligible to serve as third-party custodians to prohibit those who are likely to be called as witnesses, as opposed to those who may be called as witnesses. Page 31 of the bill contains Section 51, which provides for a probationer arrested for a technical violation to be released upon reaching the imprisonment limits that we spoke about in today's presentation. Page 31, Section 52, requires at sentencing that the court provides the victim with a form that provides information about who to contact with questions about sentencing and potential release of the offender. Page 32 contains Section 53, which is a conforming section to the addition of administrative parole as a type of parole that the court must include in its sentencing report in stating the minimum term of imprisonment the defendant must serve before becoming eligible for parole. Page 33 has Section 54, which is a conforming section to ensure that credit is applied for time spent in custody for a violation of conditions of probation or parole pending a revocation hearing. Page 33, Section 55, limits pretrial credit to 120 days for time spent on electronic monitoring that complies with the Department of Corrections guidelines. Page 33, Section 56, limits credit to 120 days against a total term of imprisonment imposed for persons crimes, sex offenses, delivery of a controlled substance to a person under 19, burglary, and arson. And to qualify as a program must address criminogenic traits and provide measures of progress, require notification to the court of probation for violations of bail or probation. This is a section that was amended heavily in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Schilling, can you pause for a moment? Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Just finished Section 56 on page 33 and 34. Mr. Schilling.
Madam Chair, for the record again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. On page 34, we have Section 57, which is a conforming section to changes that were made in the probation revocation process. Page 35 contains Section 58, which authorizes the Department of Law to garnish a permanent fund dividend to collect restitution ordered by the court. Page 35 contains Section 59, which increases the value of an hour of community work from $3 to the state's minimum wage if the defendant is unable to pay the fine and the court offers the defendant the option of performing community work in lieu of a fine. Page 35, Section 60 prevents the court from converting community work service into a sentence of imprisonment or offering the defendant the option of serving jail time in lieu of completing community work service. Page 35, Section 61 establishes a process for suspended entry of judgment whereby if a person pleads guilty to a crime, the court may, with the consent of the defense and prosecution, impose conditions of probation without imposing or entering a judgment of guilt. Upon successful completion of probation, the court shall discharge the person and dismiss the case after 1 year. Page 37 of the bill contains Section 62, which is a conforming section to the new early discharge process that we spoke of today. Page 37 of the bill contains Section 63, which limits probation terms to 10 years for an unclassified felony or felony sex offense, 5 years for any other felony offense, 4 years for a DV-related misdemeanor, 2 years for a second-time misdemeanor DUI, and 1 year for all other misdemeanor offenses. Page 38 contains Section 64, which authorizes the court to alter a term of probation in accordance with the earned compliance policy, or if a probation officer recommends to the court that the probationer be discharged from probation for successfully completing treatment and complying with the conditions of probation for a full year. Page 38 contains Section 65, which requires probation officers to recommend early discharge from probation to the court for any probationer who has served at least 1 year, completed any required treatment, and has remained in compliance with the conditions for the full year. Previously, in a former committee, sex offenders and unclassified offenders and offenders who committed a crime involving domestic violence were excluded from this policy. This policy also provides that the court shall discharge the defendant from probation upon completion of the period of probation, including the time served and earned credits. Page 39 is the beginning of Section 66, which is conforming to ensure that probationers can be required to comply with the graduated sanctions imposed by a probation officer. Page 40 contains Section 67, which conforms to renumbered statutes. Page 41 contains Section 68, which limits the maximum sentence for a technical violation of probation for probationers who are not in the PACE program to 3 days for the first revocation, 5 days for the second revocation, 10 days for the third revocation, and up to the remainder of the suspended time for the fourth or subsequent violation. Of course, there are exceptions that we just spoke about, absconding, failure to complete sex offender treatment, and failure to complete batterer's intervention programming. Page 42 contains Section 69, which is a conforming section to the addition of administrative parole as a type of parole for which the court has discretion to restrict eligibility. Page 42 contains Section 70, which increases the minimum sentence of imprisonment for murder in the first degree from 20 to 25 years. Page 43, Section 71, increases the minimum sentence of imprisonment for murder in the second degree from 10 to 15 years. Page 44 contains Section 72, which maintains the maximum sentence for a non-sex Class A felony at 20 years while reducing the presumptive range for a first felony conviction to three years from 6 years, a first felony conviction if the defendant uses a dangerous instrument or the offense is directed at a first responder from 5 years to 9 years, a second felony conviction to 8 to 12 years, and a third felony conviction to 13 to 20 years. The remainder of the section conforms to refer to the realigned changes in our drug statutes. Page 45 contains Section 73, which maintains the maximum sentence for a non-sex Class B felony at 10 years while reducing the presumptive range for a first felony conviction to 0 to 2 years, a second conviction to 2 to 5 years, and a third conviction to 4 to 10 years. The remainder conforms to the realigned misconduct involving controlled substance statutes. Page 45 is the beginning of Section 74, which maintains the maximum sentence for a non-sex Class C felony at 5 years while reducing the presumptive range for a first felony conviction to a suspended term of imprisonment of up to 18 months, a second felony conviction to 1 to 2 to 1 to 3 years and a third felony conviction to 2 to 5 years. Page 46 contains Section 75, which provides for a presumptive range of 0 to 30 days for a Class A misdemeanor, except offenses with mandatory minimums above 30 days or if the conviction is for a crime of assault in the fourth degree. The presumptive range can be overcome if the prosecution proves that the conduct constituting the offense was the most serious included in the definition of the offense, or if the defendant has past criminal convictions similar in nature to the offense in question. Page 47 contains Section 76, which reduces the maximum term of imprisonment for a Class B misdemeanor to 10 days. Page 47, Section 77, provides that the court may not impose a sentence of imprisonment or suspended imprisonment for a person convicted of theft in the fourth degree, concealment of merchandise, removal of ID marks, unlawful possession, issuing a bad check, or criminal simulation, so all shoplifting-esque type crimes, who has not been convicted of one of these theft offenses at least twice. This section also provides that the court may not impose a sentence of longer than 24 hours for a person convicted of disorderly conduct, which is a Class B misdemeanor. The court may not sentence active imprisonment for a person convicted of misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth or fifth degrees. This is simple possession unless the person has been previously convicted more than once for an offense under 1171, which is our drug statutes. Provides that if the state seeks to establish a fact-based aggravating factor at sentencing for a misdemeanor sentencing, that the factor must be established by clear and convincing evidence before the trier of fact, which in this case is the jury. If the state seeks to establish a law-based aggravating factor at sentencing, that factor must be presented. Let me go back one sec, Madam Chair, if I may. The first aggravator is a fact-based aggravator that could be proven up by the judge at a clear and convincing standard. The second aggravator is a law-based aggravator that is proven up in front of a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mr. Skidmore, if we could stop on that one. Mr. Schilling.
No, that's fine.
Mr. Skidmore actually spoke to us yesterday about this particular section and said on line 12 and 17 that those aggravators were different and pointed out whether it was supposed to be consistent or not. Do you recall that conversation?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Skidmore pointed out that...
on line 12, under 1A1B, he would question whether it should be C. Is that what it should be, or is the sponsor of the statement wanting two different?
No, Madam Chair, those are appropriate technical changes to the bill. We simply want to refer to the correct aggravators because, as I mentioned, one aggravator is proven up in front of a jury, the other is proven up by the court, the judge, and so it's just important that we refer to those aggravators correctly, and right now the bill doesn't, and so this is something that your office is aware of, and I believe it's something that would be intended to address.
It is. I just wanted to make sure we pointed it out that we were picking that up as a technical change and not exactly as it's in the document before us in the S version. Anything else on Section 77, Mr. Schilling?
No, Madam Chair. Page 48, Section 78 begins, which requires the prosecuting attorney to confer with the victim of a felony crime in regards to a proposed plea agreement at the request of the victim. This was a request by the Office of Victims' Rights to play a greater role when the Department of Law chooses to enter into a plea agreement. Page 49 contains Section 79, which requires the court to publish a court record of a person granted suspended entry of judgment or a person convicted of violation of conditions of release. Page 50 contains Section 80, which requires the DMV to restore a person's driver's license if all charges have been dismissed or if the person has been acquitted of driving while under the influence. Page 50 contains Section 81, which allows for the court to terminate a revocation if the person has successfully completed the therapeutic court program and has not been convicted of a DUI and has successfully driven under the limited license for 3 years without being revoked. Page 51 contains Section 82, which authorizes the court to grant limited license privileges for felony DUI offenders if the person has completed the therapeutic court program, has proof of insurance, and an installed ignition interlock device. This section also allows the court or the department to revoke a limited license if the person is convicted of a DUI or refusal. Page 52 contains Section 83, which is a conforming section to Section 78 that differentiates between driving while licensed suspended offenses where the underlying suspension is due to a DUI and those driving while licensed suspended offenses where the underlying reason for the revocation is unrelated to a DUI. Page 52 contains Section 84, which reduces the mandatory minimum for second time driving while licensed offenders whose license revocation is related to DUI offenses to 10 days and removes the mandatory minimum for first time DWLS offenders whose license revocation is related to DUI offenses. Also reduces the penalty for non-DUI related driving while licensed suspended offenses from a misdemeanor to a violation. Page 53 contains Section 85, which authorizes the court to reduce a license revocation for the purposes of granting a limited license to eligible offenders. Page 54 contains Section 86, which requires all first-time DUI offenders to serve their mandatory term of imprisonment on electronic monitoring, and if unavailable, imprisonment will be determined by the department. Page 55 contains Section 87, which is a conforming section that requires that the costs of imprisonment required to be paid under this section reflect the requirement to be placed on electronic monitoring. Page 55 contains Section 88, which requires the department restore a driver's license to a person who has been granted a limited license and has successfully driven on that license for 3 years without having those privileges revoked, and has also successfully completed the therapeutic court program and has not been convicted of a DUI or refusal and provides proof of insurance. Page 56 contains Section 89, which requires first-time refusal to submit offenders to serve a mandatory term of electronic monitoring. If unavailable in that region, imprisonment is determined by the department. Section 90 is contained on page 57. Which is a conforming section to the requirement that a municipality may not prescribe a greater penalty for a municipal ordinance than what is imposed for a state crime under Senate Bill 91. Page 57 of the bill contains Senate Section 91, which conforms to that same requirement that a municipality may not prescribe a greater penalty for a municipal ordinance than what is imposed for a state crime. Page 57 contains Section 92, which requires that a municipality, again, may not prescribe a greater penalty for a municipal ordinance than what is imposed for a state crime with comparable elements. Page 57 of the bill contains Section 93, which requires the commissioner to establish an administrative sanction and incentive program that we talked about today to facilitate a prompt and effective response to violations of probation. This section also requires the commissioner to establish a system of earned compliance credits, which we also spoke about today. Page 59 contains Section 94, which is a conforming section to include earned compliance credits, administrative sanctions, and early discharge to the duties of probation officers. Section 95 begins on page 59 is the beginning of Section 95. Which defines administrative sanctions and incentives to mean responses by a probation officer to a probationer's compliance or non-compliance with the conditions of probation. Page 60 contains Section 96, which establishes the pretrial services program at the Department of Corrections to conduct pretrial risk assessments, make recommendations to the court regarding release decisions, and supervise pretrial defendants who are released. This section also directs the commissioner to adopt this risk assessment tool and relevant training and regulations to implement said tool. This section also outlines the duties of pretrial services officers to conduct these assessments and make recommendations to the court. Also authorizes pretrial services officers to make diversion recommendations and to arrest defendants who have failed to appear or arrest defendants who have violated the conditions of their release. This section also requires pretrial services officers to recommend release on personal recognizance or unsecured bond for nonviolent, non-DV misdemeanors and Class C felony charges, low-risk or moderate-risk DUI charges, and other low-risk charges with limited options for departing from this requirement if the pretrial services officer finds that no combination of non-monetary conditions can reasonably ensure court appearance and public safety. Page 63 contains Section 97, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole and special medical parole as not limiting eligibility for mandatory parole. Page Page 63 is the beginning of Section 98, which is another conforming section to include that prisoners released on administrative parole are subject to the conditions of parole imposed by the board. Page 64 contains Section 99, which provides for a prisoner meeting the eligibility requirements to be released on administrative parole by the Board of Parole. Page 64 contains Section 100, conforming to ensure that the parole board shall impose conditions on all prisoners released on parole. Also, this section requires the board to consider prisoners who are eligible for administrative and discretionary parole at least 90 days before eligibility. Page 64 contains the meat of the administrative parole provision at Section 101. This creates administrative parole for inmates convicted of a first-time Class B or C felony that is not a sexual felony, and these inmates are eligible for administrative parole if they complete the requirements in their case action plan, including following all institutional rules and completing treatment requirements, and if no victim requests a hearing. Page 65 contains Section 102, which expands eligibility for discretionary parole to all inmates, excluding inmates convicted of an unclassified or sexual felony who are over the age of 60 and have served at least 10 years of their sentence. This is geriatric parole. Page 66 contains Section 103, which expands eligibility for discretionary parole to all offenders except Class A or unclassified sex offenders with prior felony convictions. Page 68 contains Section 104, which is a conforming section to the expansion of the eligibility for discretionary parole. Page 68 contains Section 105, which is another conforming section to the changes in the parole release application and decision-making process. Page 68 contains Section 106, which authorizes the parole board to grant discretionary parole to a prisoner who has been convicted of a Class A, Class B, or Class C felony, provided the prisoner is eligible for discretionary parole and has met all of the requirements of their case plan. However, if the board finds by clear and convincing evidence that the prisoner poses a threat to the public, the board may deny discretionary parole. And when considering a prisoner over the age of 60 for release on discretionary parole, the board must take into consideration the prisoner's likelihood of recidivating given the prisoner's age, as well as whether or not the prisoner poses a threat to the public. Page 69 contains Section 107, which requires the parole board to consider the inmate's case plan and reentry plan when evaluating an inmate's suitability for discretionary parole. Page 70 contains Section 108, which conforms to reflect changes made in the parole application process provisions. Page 70 contains Section 109, which is a conforming section to ensure that victims receive notification for inmates eligible for administrative parole. Page 70 contains Section 110, which conforms to the requirement that the parole board notify a victim of a crime involving DV or sexual assault 30 days in advance of discretionary and geriatric parole hearings. Additionally, the board shall inform the victim of any decision made to grant or deny parole and notify the victim of release on parole, including mandatory parole. Page 71 contains Section 111, which requires notice of a victim who has a right to receive notice from the parole board and enables the victim to request a hearing before a prisoner is administratively paroled. The notice to the victim must include the procedure for requesting a hearing. Page 71 contains Section 112, which streamlines the hearing process for discretionary parole by requiring the parole board to hold hearings for all prisoners who are eligible for parole, rather than wait for prisoners to determine eligibility and prepare an application prior to a hearing. If the board denies parole, the board shall provide a written plan to address all of the factors relevant to that denial. The board shall schedule a subsequent hearing within 2 years after the first parole eligibility date, and for additional denials within 2 years after the most recent hearing. Page 72 contains Section 113, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside the other parole types where a parole order is issued by the board that sets out the conditions of release. Page 72 contains Section 114, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside the other types of parole that carry mandatory conditions of parole. Page 73 contains Section 115, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside the other types of parole that carry conditions that can be imposed by the board or a designated member of the board. On page 74 is the beginning of Section 116, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside the other types of parole that can carry conditions imposed by a designated member of the board acting on behalf of the full board. Page 75 contains section 117, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside other types of parole that carry additional conditions for a prisoner serving a term for a crime involving domestic violence. Page 75 contains section 118, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside other types of parole that carry additional conditions for electronic monitoring if the prisoner was sentenced with an aggravating factor relating to street gangs. Page 76 contains section 119 that provides that the board may require that a prisoner serving a sentence for an offense involving the use of alcohol or controlled substances comply with a program, comply with the 24/7 sobriety program. This was an amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Page 76 contains section 120, which includes administrative parole as a type of parole that the commissioner is responsible for conducting investigations of prisoner eligibility and notifying the board within 30 days after sentencing of that potential eligibility. This section also requires the preparation of pre-parole reports and notification to the parole board of compliance or non-compliance with the prisoner's case plan no shorter than 30 days before the next parole eligibility date or hearing. The commissioner is also required to implement and administer a schedule of graduated sanctions and incentives to facilitate swift and certain response to violations, while also including a process for due, while also providing the ability for a probationer to contest the use of that sanction. Additionally, the commissioner shall facilitate the application of earned credit for compliance with the conditions of parole. Finally, this section requires the commissioner to notify the victim regarding release of an offender. Page 78 contains section 121, which is a conforming section to include administrative parole alongside the other types of parole that the board retains custody of until expiration of the maximum term of imprisonment to which the parolee is sentenced. Page 78 contains section 122, which reduces the period of time before a parolee becomes eligible for unconditional discharge from parole, in some cases to serve a residual period of probation. Page 78 contains section 123, which allows the board to initiate early discharge if the parolee has completed at least 1 year of probation, has completed all required treatment programs, and has been in compliance for a full year with all other conditions. In previous committees, those convicted of unclassified felonies, sexual felonies, or crimes involving domestic violence were excluded from this provision. The board shall also grant monthly parole incentive reductions for compliance with conditions imposed by the board. Page 78, section 124, is a provision we spoke of today, which provides for a system of imprisonment for technical violations not to exceed 3 days for the first technical, 5 days for the second, 10 days for the third, and up to the remainder for fourth and subsequent violations. For defendants found absconding or those not in compliance with sex offender programming or batterers intervention programming are excluded from this policy. Page 80 contains section 125, which is a conforming section to include the commission of a new offense or failing to complete sex offender treatment as conduct that requires a preliminary hearing to determine if a violation of the conditions of parole have occurred. Page 80, section 126, conforms to ensure that revocation hearings for technical violations of parole occur within 15 days while preserving the current process for non-technical offenses. Page 80 of the bill contains section 127, which is a conforming section to ensure that the limits on parole revocations listed in a former section apply, and also conforming to ensure that any credits a parolee has earned for compliance under section 87 of the bill cannot indirectly be taken away through the board by an extension of the term of parole. Page 80 is the beginning of section 128, which changes the parole hearing process to ensure that revocation hearings for technical violations of parole occur within 15 days. Page 81 of the bill contains section 129, which provides for a parolee arrested for a technical violation to be released upon reaching the imprisonment limits. Page 81 of the bill contains Section 130, which requires the commissioner to establish a program that allows parolees to earn credits, a policy we spoke of today, for complying with the conditions of probation, my apologies, parole. A parolee can earn a credit of 30 days for each month served in which the parolee has complied with conditions of parole. Page 81 contains Section 131, which defines administrative parole as the release of a prisoner who is eligible for administrative parole under a previous section and who has satisfied the criteria for release, subject to conditions imposed by the board and subject to its custody and jurisdiction. This section also defines what administrative sanctions and incentives are. They are a response by a parole officer to a parolee's compliance or noncompliance with the conditions of parole. Page 82 of the bill contains Section 132, which is a conforming section to the new technical violation statute, making it so technical violators are not eligible for good time credits. Page 82 contains Section 133. This section extends credit to individuals on electronic monitoring. Page 82, Section 134 allows prisoners convicted of a sexual felony to receive an earned credit upon completion of treatment requirements listed in the prisoner's case plan. As recommended by the commission, this credit was one-third. In a previous committee, the credit was reduced to one-fifth. On page 83 of the bill, section 135, again, this is duties of the commissioner, requires the commissioner of corrections to establish a program to assess risk levels for pretrial defendants, as well as establish a procedure for providing a written case plan to prisoners within 90 days of sentencing, and a reentry plan at least 90 days before release. Additionally, this section establishes standards for electronic monitoring and the approval of private contractors that provide electronic monitoring. Page 85 contains Section 136, which requires the Department of Corrections to notify the victim if the parolee is eligible for a parole reduction for compliance with conditions. Page 85 contains Section 137, which allows the Department of Corrections to enter into contracts with private electronic monitoring companies for the administration of EM. Page 86 contains Section 138, which requires the Department of Corrections to establish a program to prepare a prisoner for reentry that begins 90 days before the date of release. This program must include a reentry plan and instruction on resources available in the community, as well as instruction on obtaining state ID. Page 86 of the bill contains Section 139 relating to CRCs, which we spoke about today, community residential centers, to provide treatment and reduce mixing of low and high risk offenders and adopt a quality assurance measures, including standards for assessing risk. Page 87 of the bill contains Section 140, which is a conforming section to the realigned misconduct involving controlled substance statutes. Page 87 of the bill, Section 141, conforming to ensure that forfeiture of an appearance or performance bond is not exempted from permanent fund dividend garnishment. Page 88 of the bill contains Section 142, which provides that the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission shall annually make recommendations to the governor and the legislature on how savings from criminal justice reforms could be reinvested to reduce recidivism. This section also allows the commission to appoint a working group to review and analyze the implementation of this package, as well as enter into data sharing agreements with the University of Alaska and the Alaska Judicial Council. This is part of the oversight responsibilities of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission that I believe we'll be speaking about tomorrow morning. One sec, Madam Chair. Page 90 of the bill contains Section 143, which requires the Commission to track and analyze data collected by agencies and entities charged with implementing the recommendations. Also requires the Judiciary, the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Corrections to report data to the Commission on a quarterly basis. Page 92 contains Section 144, which requires the Commission to issue an annual report that must include a description of the past year, a summary of savings, performance measures, performance metrics, and outcomes from this recommendation package. Page 93 contains Section 145, which requires the Commission to submit the annual report no later than November 1st of each year. Page 93 of the bill contains Section 146, which extends the life of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission to 2021 in order to do the oversight work. Page 93 contains Section 147, which requires a person with a prior conviction for a controlled substance offense to participate in random drug testing if they are receiving public assistance. A positive test disqualifies a person from receiving public assistance for 6 months. Page 94 contains Section 148, which lifts the restriction on eligibility for food stamps for persons convicted of drug felonies, provided that that individual is compliant with the conditions of probation, has completed treatment, or is working towards rehabilitation. Page 94 contains Section 149, which we spoke about today, restricting ASAP referrals to persons who have been referred to the court for DUI or refusal. Page 98 contains Section 150, which requires the Department of Health and Social Services to develop regulations for the operation and management of public and private ASAP programs that ensures the uses of a validated risk assessment. Page 98 contains Section 151, which provides that ASAP assess participants for risk to reoffend and supervise them based on those risk levels. Page 98 contains Section 152, which allows the department to enter into contracts to establish and implement testing required in this section. Page 98 contains Section 153, which removes language referencing transitional reentry programs. Page 99 contains Section 154. This is some of the reinvestment language, Madam Chair. Requires that programs that increase access to evidence-based rehabilitation and support transition and reentry are the types of programs that are eligible for funding under this program. Page 99 contains Section 155, which defines evidence-based as a program or practice that offers a high level of research on that program's effectiveness. Page 99 contains the beginning of Section 156, which is an amendment to Court Rule 38 and the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure, providing for hearing reminders, reminder notices to defendants. Page 100 contains Section 157. This is more uncodified law. It's an amendment to Court Rule 41 of the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure, which prohibits bail schedules for misdemeanors or felonies. Section 158 is on page 100, which repeals Court Rules 41D and E. Page 100 contains Section 159. These are the repealers. Page 100 contains Section 160. This amends an indirect court rule amendment to the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure. Page 100 contains, my apologies, page 101 contains Section 161. This is also reinvestment language. Uncodified law that allows the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to create or expand community-based violence prevention and victim services. On page 101 is Section 162, requiring the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission to provide in 2017 a report on the evaluation of barrier offenses and collateral consequences. This was the result of an amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee. On page 102, Madam Chair, we get into the applicability provisions. That's on page 102.
Through 106.
Through 106, thanks, Madam Chair. On page 106 is section 164, providing that certain sections of the bill are conditional on a two-thirds majority vote of each House. I believe this is a result of the court rule changes included in the bill, required in the bill. On page 107, there are a variety of effective dates covered in sections 165, 166, 167, and 168 and 169. That's the end of the sectional.
Exceptional job on a very lengthy sectional analysis. The sectional analysis, for those at home, is 28 pages long and is available online also. Are there questions from committee members on the sectional analysis? Is there anything else to come before the committee? Members of the Senate Finance Committee, we're meeting tomorrow morning, Friday, April 1st, 2016, at 8 a.m. We'll be taking up Senate Bill 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill. You have that bill before you today. We will be hearing other miscellaneous sections that are included in your sectional analysis that we went through today, as well as invited testimony only from a variety of folks on issues that you've raised over the past topics. At 1 p.m. tomorrow, we will begin public testimony. It will be limited to 2 minutes. On Saturday, April 2nd, we will be discussing again, starting at 10 a.m. here in this room, 532, SB 91, the Omnibus Crime Bill. Is there anything else to come before the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
What do you have in mind for amendments for due date?
Tomorrow at 5 is the amendment due date. Anything else to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, the committee is adjourned.